Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for finding this precious time for us. It was very important for me to be able to talk to you while I'm here. We see you as one of the leading representatives of the international community in Tashkent. And as much as I am exploring the political circles in Tashkent, the Uzbek circles, I'm also eager to talk to people like you because, honestly, you've been quite active in both media and political scene in the Uzbek capital. I want you to explain your position here, the nominal and, of course, real, because, honestly, UN officials have very complicated titles. What is your title?
Thanks, Naf Bahur, and really lovely to see you here at the UN office in Uzbekistan. Currently, I have two titles. I'm the United Nations Resident Coordinator in Uzbekistan, in which capacity I'm the Secretary General's representative, coordinating the whole range of UN agencies, funds and programs, efforts to support the government with their national development priorities. My second title, which will only last for 3 or 4 more months, is UN Development Program Resident Representative, in which capacity I'm the head of UNDP, which is the biggest UN agency operating in Uzbekistan.
What will happen afterwards? Someone else is coming to do that job? Or?
Well, the member states of the United Nations agreed with the UN Secretary General's proposal for a wide-ranging set of reforms to the UN development system. And these reforms will take effect from 31 December this year. And that's when around the world, in 129 countries, including Uzbekistan, the colleagues who hold the position of resident coordinator and head of the UN country team will be delinked from UNDP. Over the past 3 or 4 decades, UNDP has provided its head of organization to be also the resident coordinator. And, of course, that has both great advantages and some challenges. And as part of the Secretary General's reform initiative, the idea is to release from day-to-day management of a big agency the resident coordinators so that we have full-time, dedicated and empowered UN representatives in country
who will lead
the whole system of the UN, both those agencies present in Uzbekistan and all the non-resident UN agencies who also engage, that we lead them to support the achievement of Agenda 2030. Because the Agenda 2030, which all countries of the world signed up to in 2015, it really is a complex, multidimensional, and very integrated program for people, planet, and prosperity. And if we don't ensure that the proper empowered leadership is there to drive results and drive change in support of national priorities and the Sustainable Development Goals, it will be challenging to achieve this hugely ambitious but exciting agenda.
When I asked you to explain your position, I really wanted to say that, you know, it's not only hard to understand the positions that UN diplomats are in, but also you cover so much. You have such multi-edged missions, right? I mean, Uzbekistan obviously is the largest country in Central Asia. Many UN agencies are involved in some way, if not just represented, you know, here in Tashkent. A very obvious question. How does one get to represent UN in a country like Uzbekistan? I know you're a career UN diplomat, but how did you end up here?
That's a very good question. So I've worked for the UN for over 2 decades, primarily working in emergencies, but I started my career in the former Soviet space, I would say, in Georgia, back in 1997. Working on humanitarian response after the conflicts that had ravaged Georgia in the early 90s. So as I gradually went through the system, through different duty stations, different roles and responsibilities, I appreciated that one of the exciting roles, where you can really draw on all aspects of the UN's amazing set of mandates and really try to focus results for change, was the role of resident coordinator. Obviously, that role demands leadership responsibilities, communication capacities, diplomacy and tact, obviously, because we are the Secretary General's representative in country, and also an ability to drive change for a set of agencies for whom you have no real direct accountability, because every agency has its own accountability line to its executive board. And in order to recruit for those positions, there's a comprehensive recruitment
process
that's called an assessment centre, where you go for 2 days along with many peers from the whole world, and you get assessed on your capacities and competencies in all of these areas that they feel are critical for these positions. Once you pass that assessment, then you're in the pool, and then you can apply to positions, resident coordinator positions, that interest you. I had visited Uzbekistan 25 years ago, and when the opening came up here, I applied, partly because, as I said, I started my career in the former Soviet space, and I feel comfortable and motivated and interested, both from a historical, a cultural, and a language perspective, because I speak Russian. Although Russian is not the official language, it's very useful in Uzbekistan. But I also felt, excited about the opportunities in Uzbekistan for sustainable development and for advancing the UN's mandate. And I was lucky enough to be appointed by the Secretary General for this position a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And when you get to be, chosen for these specific positions to be the heads of mission in countries like this, how much freedom or flexibility do you have to set your own priorities? I mean, we know that UN has its own agenda, for all the member countries. You have you have goals to accomplish. But how do you tailor everything for a country like Uzbekistan? I'm asking this because you arrived in Tashkent right when the country started changing, right? So this was a different time.
Yes, I arrived in July last year, and we were 6 months or 5-6 months into the action strategy for development, the 5-year development plan, which was frankly a sort of radical opening up towards a set of priorities that were closely linked to the sustainable development agenda, that are closely linked. Judicial reform, public administration and governance reform, economic liberalization, and foreign policy and security reform, and then, of course, critically, socioeconomic reform, including environmental issues, education and health.
So much to cover.
I know. But those five pillars really align to the UN's mandates. You know, we have, here in Uzbekistan, we have 10 resident UN agencies, and they cover the full spectrum of what is in the Action Strategy for Development. So I think the UN is well positioned as a trusted multilateral partner with no particular vested interest other than advancing the set of international obligations, conventions, standards that Uzbekistan is already signed up to in principle, but needs technical advice and support in order to align policy and practice to these standards. So it's a tremendously exciting time, and it's also a very demanding time. As much as I'm sure you've seen, the government is working extremely hard to achieve the vision outlined in the action strategy.
In many ways, you're in an envious position, because for years, let's be honest, the UN struggled to do its work here. And the Uzbek government also struggled to find a common language and to be able to, accomplish those, goals from the world body, things that were being decided in New York. We heard Uzbek foreign ministers and other officials, diplomats, talk about how disappointed they were with the UN, how UN wasn't enough supportive enough to push for change in the region. And there was a lot of criticism back and forth. We also saw the world body, represented here, sort of paralyzed for a long time. They were not being able to do their work because of various restrictions, because of various policies in place here. So you really came in when the system was opening up. Do you see that opening continuing? Where do you see Uzbekistan right now?
Well, first I would say the UN has been in Uzbekistan for 25 years, so just since 93. And although indeed, as you say, there were challenges, I wouldn't say that the partnership in those years did not reap fruit. In fact, interestingly, many of the openings that we're seizing now build on support, advice, and input that the UN has provided over the past decades. So I wouldn't like you to come away with the impression that the UN was here and unable to work. That's not the case. There was a lot of very constructive engagement, but there were also very significant challenges, particularly in areas which were difficult to discuss, including maybe youth, migration issues, human rights issues, rule of law reform, indeed, and recommendations coming to Uzbekistan were difficult to follow through in some areas. Nevertheless, the UN remained engaged. Those recommendations were carried in. And now we're seeing that many of the fruits of that engagement are, now coming to fruition, if I can say that. For example, we gave support to Uzbekistan over 10, 12 years ago, I think, on WTO accession, before it was put on pause. And now we're bringing out some of those policy papers and supporting the government to reopen its perspective on WTO accession. For example, UNESCO has been supporting the government on management plan concepts for the outstanding areas of universal cultural heritage. And, there were some challenges, and now that, again, is opening up and that UNESCO is able to provide more engagement and support for management plans for Khiva and Bukhara, etc. So that's my first point. The second point that you mentioned, you asked, where do I see Uzbekistan now? Well, we're 2 years into a change.
The reforms.
Yeah, the reforms, although they were articulated and framed only in February last year. But, we're 2 years into a change of administration, a change of approach, and a very citizen-oriented approach, which I think is one thing that for the UN is really important. And we've certainly provided a lot of support on the ability of citizens to engage in the process of reform and give their input and feedback. And I would say that we've passed, in my view, the tipping point where these reforms are reversible.
Mm.
I believe.
So you don't worry that the system may go back?
I don't think so. I think, you can see very clearly a very strong vision and a very clear vision of where the country wants to go. The country wants to create jobs, create opportunity, and change in a way the compact between the citizens of Uzbekistan and the government of Uzbekistan to a place where the citizens are consumers and clients and agents. And I think that is really a critical place. We also see definitely that the outreach and opening up under Pillar 5 of the Action Strategy to neighbours, the Central Asian countries first and foremost, but Afghanistan critically also, and then to the wider community, and we had President Lukashenko here, as you know, first state visit in 24 years. We had President Sisi from Egypt. And, we are having a level of international engagement, a determination for connectivity with all the opportunities and the challenges that that provides. And I think that is also irreversible. So I would say, and I believe that I speak for many of the multilateral partners in Uzbekistan, Uzbekistan is really shifting to a range of opportunities across all aspects of the reform, which will lead, maybe not tomorrow, but we very strongly believe and hope soon, to the shifts, for example, in productivity and in employment that are absolutely critical in this young country, where with a growing population of youth entering the job market, but also, to a situation where the rights and dignities of the human are a fundamental part of the compact between government and the people?
Well, the UN goals are usually long-term. You have a long-term vision. You want to be able to envision the society, and as you said, in 30 years, in 50 years, for example, like 2030, you know, 2030 goals. But people want tangible results now. And when I talk to the public, also to the Uzbek government, they want to deliver now, and they seem to be struggling, which in many ways is very natural. And the challenge is like, how do you prove that you're effective, that you're productive now? How can the UN help in that to the government?
It's a very good point. The balance between the long-term strategic objectives and quick wins is always a challenging one, particularly in Uzbekistan, which is really trying to transform on all fronts at once. The great advantage that Uzbekistan has is that it is transitioning its economy 20 years in some cases after other countries in the region and beyond transitioned. And there's a lot that can be learned, and Uzbekistan is cleverly learning from it. And it's not just from the former Soviet countries, it's, you know, Vietnam, Korean experience, you know, other countries that are trying to leapfrog ahead, or tried to leapfrog ahead and successfully achieved that. And I think one clear lesson that emerges from many of these experiences is indeed the balance between staying focused on the long term, because you can't run a transition of this kind on an electoral cycle. Because if you focus only on the short-term wins, you will have to end up making compromises that don't, you know, for example, on environmental change, for, you know, big issue for Uzbekistan, big challenges, their transboundary challenges. We've seen the Aral Sea crisis. But if you only stay focused on the next 2 or 3 years, you're not going to begin to safeguard the environment for future generations, which is absolutely vital if you're also trying to create jobs, frankly. So I think it's critical, and I see Uzbekistan trying to stay focused. For the first time, as you know, the government has commissioned long-term sectoral and regional development strategies with intra-government coordination mechanisms within those strategies. Let me give you another concrete example where the UN is trying to help and where also these quick wins come in, and that's in the health reform. So Uzbekistan's health system, I think we can all acknowledge, is underinvested and outdated in terms of taking opportunities of information technology, data capacities, etc., to manage the health challenges of the 21st century, one of which is non-communicable diseases. 80% of mortality and morbidity in Uzbekistan is associated with risk factors linked to non-communicable diseases. That's really high. The government is therefore losing money. People are losing their lives, more importantly, on issues that could be addressed through a really strategic, long-term non-communicable diseases plan. So how do you do that in a way that brings some quick wins? Because if we just focus on people's health over the next 15 years, the population will be frustrated. They want to see their health clinics improve now. They want to see diagnostics improve now. They want access to,
you know, basic healthcare now.
Basic healthcare, pharmaceuticals, you know, et cetera, now. So I think it's critical that the World Health Organization has stepped in and understands the need to provide some of that basic infrastructural and primary healthcare wins now. But because it's the World Health Organization, has a long-term vision, it's also really supporting and advising the Ministry of Health and the Presidential Commission on Health Reform on the long-term goals and objectives. And I think the UN, we have a duty to do that. One of the beauties of the UN is it can stay focused on the long-term. That's our...
And the system is kind of set for that.
We're here as partners for as long as it requires, you know? Come hell or high water, as it were, the UN will stay. And I think we have shown that. And yes, in some cases, challenges that we would like to see addressed, you know, are moving at a slower pace. Challenges Others are moving at a faster pace. The point is that we, in my job as coordinator, is to try to make sure that we support national priorities, and we support those national priorities in line with the international best standards, as well as the treaties and obligations and commitments that Uzbekistan has signed up to. And I hope that that overall package means a win for the government and a win for the people of Uzbekistan.
So as I listen to you, I am thinking of this criticism that I hear mainly in Washington, in the West, specifically from various human rights organizations and other critics, basically, who say that, you know, the UN is just being too positive about Uzbekistan. They're just cheerleading too much instead of pushing the government to change, instead of pushing to accelerate whatever reforms that the system is ready to do. They've joined this bandwagon, and they're promoting the interests of the current administration, the interests of the of President Mirziyoyev and his mission. What do you see to that? Like, you're not really questioning the policy, but just kind of unconditionally supporting it.
Well, I would invite those critics to come to Uzbekistan and talk to me and my colleagues in the UN country team about what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. Because I don't think they're necessarily basing that on a deep understanding of how the UN operates. In my public-facing diplomacy, I am indeed, where appropriate, applauding movement in the right direction. And I believe strongly that that is the role of the UN, to support and applaud positive movement and positive trajectories. The work we do with the government, however, is not primarily that public diplomacy. It's the really pragmatic day-to-day conversations we're having behind closed doors. And across the range of our work, whether it's in education, in health, in public administration, in human rights, in rule of law, in copying labour reform challenges, in climate action, we have both difficult and constructive and positive conversations. We push, we engage, we support. The UN has a range of roles, and I would say the most important point is we are here at the request of government to support national priorities in line with international conventions, commitments, standards. And that's what we do. But I don't see any value in working in a way that would project me as being an NGO activist. I'm not an NGO activist. There is a role, and a very important role, and I commend the role of our NGO partners. I commend the role of the journalists who are looking at the challenges, opportunities, questioning. There's a different role. My role is to work in support of the government. And as I said, I really welcome anybody to come and question and talk to us if they feel we're not upholding UN principles and standards, because I'm fully confident that we are.
Do you encourage the Uzbek government to provide more access to outside groups, maybe to boost the presence of the civil society in this country? I know you work with the local communities, you work with local NGOs in many sectors, like you mentioned earlier, but at the same time, how much do you think you engage the public? Because, I mean, I guess it's safe to say that not many people, the ordinary folks, don't really know much about the intricate details of your day-to-day work, right? Mm-hmm. How do you promote yourself inside the country?
Well, I feel like there's many aspects to your question.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I'm asking a lot of things.
Yes. So let me try and break it down a bit.
Sure.
On the issue of civil society, I see it very clearly under my role as a champion of the Sustainable Development Goals, that our stakeholders and partners, it's not only government. Yes, we're here at the government's request. Yes, we're here to engage with government and support them through this reform process. But also civil society is a critical partner to the UN in all its areas of work. And opening up further space for civil society is important to them. And I believe that the UN country team is properly engaged in that respect, in our work with the Ministry of Justice, in our work directly with NGOs in Uzbekistan,
and in the advocacy and engagement that we provide. For example, we routinely ensure that NGOs are invited to events and seminars where they would have a voice and a role, and we routinely encourage their engagement. And I would say, for example, the presence of Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, for example, at recent discussions in Tashkent on human rights is also linked to our advocacy and engagement.
And we see local human rights activists too in various events.
Exactly. My colleagues in the ILO have made an absolute point of ensuring that local human rights activists are engaged in the dialogue on labour reform. And that is now a policy enshrined in Ministry of Labour practice. And I really applaud and welcome that, because that's a breakthrough. So I think from a civil society perspective, there's lots to do. But I believe that we're working in the right direction. On the question of how we engage with the wider community, there's a number of ways. I mean, first is, you know, person-to-person contacts.
Which is very important.
Yeah. So in the run-up to the United Nations General Assembly Youth Dialogue, we invited a bunch of young people. And these were not pre-selected by, you know, some body. They were a bunch of young people. Some were nominated by youth partners that we engage with. Some were nominated by universities that I've had contact with through support to different lectures or Model United Nations efforts. Some are young people that we've come across and have expressed an interest in supporting our mandate and mission. We get a lot of volunteers coming to say, can we help? And we framed that engagement not only as a way to support advancing Uzbekistan's reform agenda through engaging with the UN, but also as an opportunity to give diverse set of inputs from young people about what priorities they see we should be focusing on. Going forward, I'm hoping we will have some kind of youth network for the SDGs in Uzbekistan. This is what I'm moving towards. And I think that would be an essential part of ensuring that the voice of youth is really helping to drive our sense of priorities. And we recently managed to get the Secretary General's youth envoy to Uzbekistan. That was a great trip. And actually, I hosted a dinner at my house for her with young leaders. And again, they were not young leaders that were nominated from a certain part of government. They were a range of young leaders. I also try to engage with some schools and my colleagues as well. Obviously, UNICEF is often engaged with school children, but I try to engage with school children. I was invited to the academic lycée under the University for Oriental Languages to come talk to them about the role of the UN. I really enjoy those people-to-people contacts.
How do you explain the mission of the UN in simple words? It's hard to do so. Especially when you are leading a team that represents so many different parts of the UN, so many different missions. Again, we keep on going back to the goals and missions. But when you, for the ordinary folks, UN is up there. You know, it's not only just some kind of an elite organization, but it's something unreachable. You know, something that is not necessarily interested or engaged in the lives of the ordinary folks. What is UN now?
Again, a really good question, multifaceted. The UN now is a set of global experience, good practice, and standards that helps countries increase their prosperity, ensure peace and security, and ensure the dignity of the person and human rights for all. Those are the three mandates of the UN, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Development, sustainable development, peace and security, and human rights. And how we do that is a mix of technical support, advice, practical, you know, for example, in Zarafshan, near Tajikistan border, we are supporting the renovation of a canal. But then we're also engaging with the local community to support them to learn how to best negotiate access to water for the families who have small market gardens and in the past had a difficult time because most of the water was sent to the big farms. So we're also engaging with communities, listening to their needs. How do they need to shape their water use and their rights to access water for their market gardens so they can sell produce, feed their families, etc., and at the same time, fulfill our more infrastructural approach of rehabilitating a canal. So I would say a lot of what the UN does is about engaging with communities. Let me give you another example, the Aral Sea region. And you asked how we would ensure the voice of communities informs our work. Well, in Karakol, Pakistan, which, as you know, is the large region, autonomous, semi-autonomous region around the Aral Sea with over a million inhabitants, and it's the poorest and most vulnerable region of Uzbekistan, according to all indicators, unemployment, health, environmental challenges.
Uzbekistan sounds called the forgotten land, essentially.
Yes. So we have a joint program, a UN joint program in the Aral Sea region. And when I say UN joint program, that sounds complicated. What it means is five UN agencies have come together to pool their technical capacity and their know-how to meet people's needs. And how did we do that? We went out and we conducted a survey with thousands of households to understand their needs, their perspectives on what their priorities are. Unsurprisingly, the main needs that they have are jobs, health,
drinking water,
and education for their kids. So some of them are in remote villages, it's difficult to get their kids to work to school, etc. They're dissatisfied with the quality. And so this is the first time such a human-oriented survey has been conducted. We published the results. The data is all open access. And again, that's a first. And obviously it was a partnership with the Karakol Pak authorities. And then we've designed and are executing different projects to help these communities rise out of poverty and deal with the fact that they're living in the shadow of this environmental catastrophe. But we always make sure that communities are involved in the feedback loop and that we understand what their needs are. So we're talking to women-headed households where the men have gone on migration and they're basically saying, I can't feed my children. And we help them, for example, with a small greenhouse to grow tomatoes, which are needed in the market at certain times of year, and have good irrigation practices so they use less water because there's so little water, etc., etc. That's, for me, that kind of work is really flagship. You know, it's addressing, and it's a good way to encapsulate the role of the UN. We're addressing human dignity. We're addressing challenges around prosperity. And we're also addressing possible future challenges around conflict in the community because of lack of water, because of environmental hazards, and so forth. We're doing this in partnership with the communities, but also in partnership with the government.
Well, another multifaceted question, my last question. I know you have a very busy day, and I really appreciate you, your patience and even sitting down with me for this wonderful conversation. We hear so much talk about, you know, holding up the international obligations, following the international laws. The government talks a lot about it. They want to be obedient followers of the international, of their international obligations. And we also hear from the government that UN should lead. Whenever there is any kind of a talk about the role of the United Nations, the Uzbek officials, diplomats say that, well, we want the UN to lead. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to follow them. What is that message about? How do you understand that?
So the UN is always going to be there to support any of our member states to reach international standards that they have signed up to. So let me give an example. For example, the Convention on Biodiversity or the Montreal Protocol on eliminating the use of hydrochlorofluorocarbons, which I'm doing an event on later today, because it's annual Ozone Layer Day, International Day for the Preservation of the Ozone Layer. And we are helping and supporting the government of Uzbekistan to realise its commitments under both of those conventions and treaties. And that means partly helping the government report and ensure they have the data available to say what they're doing to preserve biodiversity and what further challenges they are facing. Or in the case of the Montreal Protocol, we're providing concrete technical support to replace coolant in air conditioning units in hospitals around Uzbekistan so that we are ensuring Uzbekistan meets its commitment to eradicate the use of ozone-polluting substances. So it ranges from very practical technical work, training air coolant technicians on replacing and managing these types of refrigerants, for example, to more policy work, what legislation needs to be changed, for example, so that it's illegal to import substances which are banned under various protocols. That's one area of how the UN supports countries, including Uzbekistan. On the human rights side, for example, we also take stock of and support the government to address recommendations coming from different human rights treaty bodies. Another practical example is the recommendations on the Convention of the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And there are a number of recommendations from the UN on this issue. And we're currently helping the Women's Committee and other parts of government to elaborate, for example, a law on domestic violence, which is a really important issue, as well as a concept for a law on the equality of women and men in Uzbekistan. Now, that is enshrined, that equality is enshrined in Uzbekistan's constitution, but it's important to have the appropriate legal structure in place so that women indeed don't face discrimination, whether it's in the issue of job applications or university entrance or political participation. So across the range of international standards, our role is to provide the technical advice, the policy experience, and in some cases the practical on-the-ground support for enabling a country to follow and reach the standards it's committed to.
So obviously the policymakers, you know, of Uzbekistan and elsewhere, listening to you, will be making certain marks, right? Oh yeah, UN is doing this, UN is doing that. So, you know, the point of this conversation was basically to outline or to dive into the work of the UN in Uzbekistan. But if the ordinary folks are wondering about how can I be a part of that or this initiative, how can I participate in that or this program, you know, in the regions or here in the capital, what can they do? What would you say to those Uzbeks who say, I want to be a part of what UN is doing now and I want to believe in their, I want to contribute and believe in their work?
Well, I would like to say to anybody watching this program, we want you as partners. The UN is willing to engage and support. And how can you do that? The first way is to learn about what your country has signed up to. Obviously, the action strategy, which is the National Development Plan, but also the Sustainable Development Goals. The government is on the verge of adopting its own national targets and indicators. It's critical that every Uzbek should know what the collective spirit of Uzbekistan is trying to achieve under all the goals that the whole world has aspired to and signed up to. Secondly, you should educate yourself about the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. This is the 70th anniversary, and Uzbekistan has passed a specific decree to celebrate this, and we really welcome that. And I think it's important every Uzbek should know what's in the Universal Declaration and to understand what's been committed to there. And then thirdly, once those big picture objectives are clear, act as agents for helping to change so that your government can achieve, together with the people, those really great aspirational objectives that are enshrined in Agenda 2030 and in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Concretely, you can engage in your community to raise awareness, for example, on conservation of water, on preservation of the rich biodiversity or the cultural heritage of Uzbekistan. You can engage by writing to your local Oli Majlis representative or to your senator and saying, I'm really inspired by these commitments. You know, we would like to see this happening in our regional district. And this kind of engagement, this kind of motivation is important for government and for the Oli Majlis to understand. And on our side, we always welcome volunteers who want to support our mission by talking about the aspirations of Uzbekistan to achieve sustainable prosperity and dignity for all its citizens. And we welcome concrete participation and community input to our work.
Thank you so much.